just over 2 hours north of New York City. They spent the summer of 2003 living in the country, working the farm, growing a garden, hosting their kids and grandkids, and enjoying a more relaxed life than what they're used to in Cleveland, Ohio. S and Anne have a modest house, a large rectangular converted storage building. The simplicity of it belies the fact that this is one of the oldest family farms in America. Only upon closer inspection does it become apparent that there is something unusual about this place. Hanging on the wall is a framed certificate from New York State given to the Esselstein family in recognition of their family farm, one that has now seen parts of 5 different centuries. Nearby, an oar hangs on the wall. It is the oar S used in 1955 as an oarsman at Yale, when Yale beat Harvard by 5 seconds. S explains he has 3 other oars, 2 from beating Harvard in other years, and 1 for winning the gold medal in the Olympics with the Yale crew in 1956. Downstairs, there is an exceptionally old photograph of S's great-great-grandfather on the farm. Around the corner, there's an impressive-looking museum-style schematic of the Esselstein family tree. And at the other end of the hall, there's a large black-and-white picture of S's father standing in front of a microphone, exchanging comments with John F. Kennedy during a White House address. Despite its humble appearance, it is very clear that this is a place with a distinguished history. After touring the farm on a tractor, we sat down with S. and asked him about his past. After graduating from Yale, he was trained as a surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic and at St. George's Hospital in London. He remembers fondly some of his most influential mentors, Dr. George Crile, Jr., Dr. Turnbull, and Dr. Brook. Dr. Crile, a giant at the Cleveland Clinic, eventually became S.'s father-in-law upon S.'s marriage to Anne. Dr. Crile was a man of exceptional accomplishment, playing a courageous leading role in questioning the macabre surgery called radical mastectomy. Dr. Turnbull and Dr. Brook were also renowned surgeons. In addition, S.'s own father was a distinguished physician with a national reputation. But, as S. remembers, despite being health experts, all 4 of these men were ravaged by cardiovascular disease. His own father had a heart attack at age 42, and Dr. Brook had a heart attack at age 52. These were the men he looked up to, and when it came to cardiovascular disease, all of them were helpless. Shaking his head, S. said, "You can't escape this disease. These people who were giants in the prime of their years just withered." As he took a moment to remember his father, he said, "It was the last year or two of my dad's life, and we were just strolling along one day. He was saying, 'We are going to have to show people how to lead healthier lives.' He was right on it. He was intensely interested in preventive medicine, but he didn't have any information." His father's interest has been a driving influence in S.'s life. Following in these men's footsteps, S. went on to amass an extraordinarily impressive list of awards and credentials: an Olympic gold medal in rowing, a Bronze Star for military service in Vietnam, president of the staff, member of the Board of Governors, chairman of the Breast Cancer Task Force, and head of the section of thyroid and parathyroid surgery at the Cleveland Clinic, one of the top-ranked medical institutions in the world, president of the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons, over 100 professional scientific articles, and inclusion on a list in 1994 to 1995 of the best doctors in America. He remembers, "For about a 10 to 15 year period, I was the top earner in the Department of General Surgery. As Dr. Crile's son-in-law, I was panicked about not pulling my weight. I didn't get home until late at night, but I had a position that was secure." When the then president of the American Medical Association needed thyroid surgery, he wanted S. to be the one to operate. But despite the accolades, the titles, and the awards, something was not right. So often, S's patients did not regain their health, even after his best efforts. As S described it, he had this haunting feeling that was really beginning to bother me. I kept looking at how the patients were doing after these operations. Slightly exasperated, he said, "What is the survival rate for cancer of the colon? It's not so great." He recounted the operation for colon cancer on one of his best friends. During surgery, they saw that the cancer had spread throughout the intestines. S lowered his voice ever so slightly in remembering this, saying, "You get there after the horse has left the barn." In thinking about all the breast surgery he had done, the lumpectomies and mastectomies, he expressed disgust at the idea of disfiguring somebody when you know that you haven't changed their chances for recovery. He began to do some soul searching. "What is my epitaph going to be? 5,000 mastectomies. You've disfigured more women than anybody else in Ohio." Dropping the sarcasm, he said with sincerity, "I think everybody likes to leave the planet thinking that maybe, maybe, you've helped a little." Dr. Esselstein began studying the literature on the diseases he commonly treated. He read some of the popular work of Dr. John McDougall, who had just written a best-selling diet and health book called The McDougall Plan. He read the scientific literature that compared international disease rates and lifestyle choices, and a study by a University of Chicago pathologist showing that a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet fed to non-human primates could reverse atherosclerosis. He came to the realization that the diseases that so often plagued his patients were due to a diet rich in meat, fat, and highly refined foods. As mentioned in Chapter 5, he got the idea to treat heart patients with a low-fat, plant-based diet, and in 1985 went to the head of the Cleveland Clinic to discuss his study. She said that nobody had ever shown that heart disease in humans could be reversed by using dietary treatment. Still, S knew he was on the right track, and went about quietly conducting his study over the next several years. The study he published of 18 patients with heart disease demonstrated the most dramatic reversal of heart disease in the history of medicine, simply by using a low-fat, plant-based diet and a minimal amount of cholesterol-reducing medication. Esselstein has become a champion of dietary treatment of disease, and he has the data to prove his case. But it hasn't been easy. Rather than recognizing him as a hero, some in the medical establishment would rather he disappear. Somewhere in this transition from top-ranked, self-described, macho, hard-ass surgeon to dietary advocate, he has become known, behind his back, as Dr. Sprouts. A Daunting Task. What's interesting about this story is that a man who had reached the pinnacle of a highly respected profession dared to try something different, succeeded, and then quickly found himself on the outside of the establishment looking in. He had threatened the status quo by circumventing standard treatments. Some of S's colleagues have disparaged his treatment as being too extreme. Some doctors have dismissed it by saying, "I think the research in this area is pretty soft," which is an absurd comment considering the breadth and depth of the international studies, the animal studies, and the intervention studies. Some doctors have said to S, "Yeah, okay, but nobody is going to eat like that. I can't even get my patients to stop smoking." S's response was, "Well, you really have no training in this. This requires just as much expertise as doing a bypass. It takes 3 hours for me to counsel a patient, not to mention the diligence required for the constant follow-up and monitoring of the patient's health." One patient told his cardiologist that he wanted to see S and commit to a dietary program to reverse his heart disease. The cardiologist responded, "Now you listen to me. There is no way to reverse this disease." You'd think that doctors would be more excited about healing their patients. In talking about doctors and their unwillingness to embrace a WFPB diet, S says, "You can't get frustrated. These aren't evil people. There are 60 cardiologists at the Cleveland Clinic, any number of whom are closet believers in what I do, but they're a little afraid because of the power structure. For S., however, it has been impossible to avoid his share of frustration. Early on, when he was first suggesting dietary treatment of heart disease, colleagues greeted the idea with caution. S. figured that their attitude was born out of the fact that scientific research showing effective dietary intervention of heart disease in humans wasn't yet strong enough. But later, scientific results of unparalleled success, including Esselstein's, were published. The data have been strong, consistent, and deep, yet S. still encountered reluctance to embrace this idea. You take a cardiologist, and he's learned all about beta blockers. He's learned about calcium antagonists. He's learned about how to run this catheter up into your heart and blow up balloons or laser it or stent it without killing you, and it's very sophisticated. And there's all these nurses, and there's lights out, and there's drama. I mean, it's just, oh my God, the doctor blows up the balloon in his head. The ego of these people is enormous. And then someone comes along and says, you know, I think we can cure this with Brussels sprouts and broccoli. The doctor's response is, what? I learned all this crap. I'm making a freaking fortune, and you want to take it all away? Then, when that person comes along and actually cures patients with Brussels sprouts and broccoli, as Esselstein did, and gets better results than any other pill or procedure known, you've suddenly announced that something works, hands down, better than what 99% of the profession is doing. Summarizing his point, S. says, cardiologists are supposed to be experts in diseases of the heart, and yet they have no expertise in treating heart disease. And when that awareness strikes them, they get very defensive. They can treat the symptoms. They can take care of arrhythmias. They can get you interventions. But they don't know how to treat the disease, which is a nutritional treatment. Imagine a dietitian training a heart surgeon. Esselstein has found that merely saying that patients can have control over their own health is a challenge to many. These experts, after all, are built up to be the dispensers of health and healing. Intellectually, it's very challenging to think that the patient can do this with greater alacrity, dispatch, safety, and it's something that's going to endure. With all of the doctor's gadgets, technologies, training, and knowledge, nothing is more effective than guiding the patient to make the right lifestyle choices. But S. is quick to point out that doctors are not malicious people engaged in a conspiracy. The only person that likes change is a newborn, and it's natural. It's human nature. Anywhere you go, 99% of the people are eating incorrectly. The numbers are against you, and it's very hard for those 99% to look at you in the 1% and say, yes, he's right. We are all wrong. Another obstacle, lack of nutrition knowledge among physicians. S. has had his share of interaction with ignorant doctors, and his impression is that it's absolutely daunting the lack of physician knowledge that there is about the fact that disease can be reversed. You wonder, what is the literature that these guys read? Physician knowledge often involves only the standard treatments, pills, and procedures. What does the 20th century of medicine have to offer? We have pills, and we have procedures, right? Esselstein leans forward, and with a slight grin, as if he's about to tell us the emperor has no clothes, he says, but whoever says, maybe we ought to stop disease. In Dr. Esselstein's experience, stopping disease does not figure prominently into the status quo. Lack of training. The medical status quo relies heavily on medication and surgery, to the exclusion of nutrition and lifestyle. Doctors have virtually no training in nutrition and how it relates to health. In 1985, the United States National Research Council funded an expert panel report that investigated the quantity and quality of nutrition education in U.S. medical schools. the committee's findings were clear. The committee concluded that nutrition education programs in U.S. medical schools are largely inadequate to meet the present and future demands of the medical profession. But this finding was nothing new. The committee noted that in 1961, the American Medical Association Council on Foods and Nutrition reported that nutrition in the U.S. medical schools received inadequate recognition, support, and attention. In other words, over 40 years ago, the doctors themselves said that their nutrition training was inadequate. Nothing had changed by 1985, and up to the present time, articles continue to be written documenting the lack of nutrition training in medical schools. This situation is dangerous. Nutrition training of doctors is not merely inadequate, it is practically non-existent. The 1985 National Research Council report found that physicians receive, on average, only 21 classroom hours, about 2 credits, of nutrition training during their 4 years of medical school. The majority of the schools surveyed actually taught less than 20 contact hours of nutrition, or 1 to 2 credit hours. By comparison, an undergraduate nutrition major at Cornell will receive 25 to 40 credit hours of instruction, or about 250 to 500 contact hours. Registered dietitians will have more than 500 contact hours. It gets worse. The bulk of these nutrition hours are taught in the first year of medical school, as part of other basic science courses. Topics covered in a basic biochemistry course may include nutrient metabolism and/or biochemical reactions involving certain vitamins or minerals. In other words, nutrition is often not taught in relation to public health problems like obesity, cancer, diabetes, etc. In conjunction with the 1985 government report, the president of the American Medical Students Association, William Kassler, writes, "Most nutrition in the formal curriculum is incorporated into other courses. Biochemistry, physiology, and pharmacology are the courses most often alleged to contain some nutrition instruction. Too often in such courses, nutrition is touched on briefly, with the primary emphasis on the major discipline. It is quite possible to finish such a course and not even realize that nutrition was covered. Nutrition taught by those whose interest and expertise lie elsewhere simply doesn't work." It gets even worse. When nutrition education is provided in relation to public health problems, guess who is supplying the educational material? The Danon Institute, Egg Nutrition Board, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, National Dairy Council, Nestle Clinical Nutrition, Wyeth Erst Laboratories, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Baxter Healthcare Corporation, and others have all joined forces to produce a Nutrition in Medicine program and the Medical Nutrition Curriculum Initiative. Do you think that this all-star team of animal foods and drug industries representatives is going to objectively judge and promote optimal nutrition, which science has shown to be a WFPB diet that minimizes the need for drugs? Or might they try to protect the meat-centered Western diet where everyone expects to pop a pill for every sickness? This organization is creating nutrition curricula on CD-ROMs and giving them away to medical schools for free. As of late 2003, 112 medical schools were using the curriculum. According to their website at the time, plans are underway for developing versions for undergraduate nutrition students, continuing medical education, and other health professions audiences. The dairy industry has also funded research investigations into nutrition education in medical schools and has funded prestigious awards. These efforts show that industry is well prepared to promote its monetary interests whenever the opportunity presents itself. You should not assume that your doctor has any more knowledge about food and its relation to health than your neighbors and co-workers. It's a situation in which nutritionally untrained doctors prescribe milk and sugar-based meal replacement shakes for overweight diabetics, high-meat, high-fat diets for patients who ask how to lose weight, and extra milk for patients who have osteoporosis. The health damage that results from doctors' ignorance of nutrition is astounding. Apparently, there aren't enough nutrition-oriented physician role models in medical education. One survey found a shortage of nutrition-oriented physician role models is probably the major constraint in teaching nutrition to residents. It may be that these medical programs lack nutrition-oriented physicians simply because they do not make it a priority to hire them. Nobody knows this better than Dr. John McDougall. Dr. McDougall's challenge. Dr. John McDougall has been advocating a WFPB approach to health longer than any practitioner we know. He has written 10 books, including several that have sold over 500,000 copies each. His nutrition and health knowledge is phenomenal, greater than any other doctor we've met, and greater than any of our nutrition colleagues in academia. Colin met John in his Northern California home, and one of the first things he showed Colin was his bank of 4 or 5 full-size metal file cabinets lined up along the back of his study. There can't be many people in the country with a collection of scientific literature on diet and disease that could rival John McDougall's. And, most importantly, John maintains a high level of familiarity with all of it. It is not unusual for him to spend a couple of hours a day on the internet reviewing the latest journal articles. If anybody would be a perfect nutrition-oriented physician role model in an educational setting, it would be Dr. John McDougall. Growing up, John ate a rich Western diet. As he says, he had 4 feasts a day: Easter during breakfast, Thanksgiving at lunch, Christmas at dinner, and a birthday party for dessert. It caught up to him, and at the age of 18, a few months into college, John had a stroke. After recovering with a new appreciation for life, he became a straight-A student as an undergraduate, and then completed medical school in Michigan and an internship in Hawaii. He chose to practice on the Big Island of Hawaii, where he cared for thousands of patients, some of whom had recently migrated from China or the Philippines, and some who were fourth-generation Chinese or Filipino-Americans. It was there that John became an unhappy doctor. Many of his patients' health problems were a result of chronic illnesses such as obesity, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and arthritis. John would treat them as he was taught, with the standard sets of pills and procedures, but very few of them became healthy. Their chronic diseases didn't go away, and John quickly realized that he had severe limitations as a doctor. He also started to learn something else from his patients, the first and second generation Americans from Asia, the ones who ate more traditional Asian staple diets of rice and vegetables, were trim, fit, and not afflicted with the chronic diseases that plagued John's other patients. The third and fourth generation Asian Americans, however, had fully adopted America's eating habits and suffered from obesity, diabetes, and the whole host of other chronic diseases. It was from these people that John began to notice how important diet was for health. Because John wasn't healing people, and the pills and procedures weren't working, he decided he needed more education and entered a graduate medical program, residency, at the Queens Medical Center in Honolulu. It was there that he began to understand the boundaries that the medical establishment had set, and the way that medical education molds the way doctors are supposed to think. John went into the program hoping to find out how to perfect the pills and procedures so that he could become a better doctor. But after observing experienced doctors treating their patients with pills and procedures, he realized that these authoritative doctors didn't do any better than he did. Their patients didn't just stay sick, they got worse. John realized something was wrong with the system, not him, so he began to read the scientific literature. Like Dr. Esselstein, once he did so, John became convinced that a WFPB diet had the potential not only to prevent these diseases that were plaguing patients, but also the potential to treat them. This idea, he was to find out, was not received kindly by his teachers and colleagues. In this environment, diet was considered quackery. John would ask, "Doesn't diet have something to do with heart disease?" And his colleagues would tell him that the science was controversial. John continued to read the scientific research and to talk to his colleagues, but only became even more baffled. "When I looked at the literature, I couldn't find the controversy. It was absolutely clear what the literature said." Through those years, John came to understand why so many physicians claimed diet was controversial. The scientist is sitting down at the breakfast table, and in the one hand he has a paper that says that cholesterol will rot your arteries and kill you, and in the other hand he has a fork shoveling bacon and eggs into his mouth, and he says, "There's something confusing here. I'm confused." And that's the controversy. That's all it is. John tells a story about seeing a 38-year-old man and his wife after the man had suffered a second heart attack. As the resident physician, not their primary attending physician, he asked the patient what he was going to do to prevent a third fatal heart attack. "You're 38 years old, with a beautiful young wife, 5 kids. What are you going to do to keep your wife from being a widow and your kids from becoming fatherless?" The man was despondent, frustrated, and said, "There's nothing I can do. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I exercise. I follow the same diet the dietitian gave me after my last heart attack. There's nothing more I can do." John told the couple what he had been learning about diet. He suggested that the man might reverse his disease if he ate the right way. The patient and his wife received the news with enthusiasm. John talked with them for quite a long time, left the room, and felt great. He had finally helped someone. He had finally done his job. That lasted for about 2 hours. He was called into the chief of medicine's office. The chief of medicine wields absolute authority over the residents. If he fires a resident, not only is that person out of his or her job, that person is out of his or her career. The excited couple had told their attending physician what they had just learned. The doctor replied that what they had been told wasn't true, and promptly reported John to the chief of medicine. The chief of medicine had a serious conversation with John, who remembers being told that, "I was stepping far beyond my duties as a resident. I should get serious about medicine and give up all this nonsense about food having anything to do with disease." The chief of medicine made it clear that on this point, John's job and his subsequent career was on the line. So John bit his tongue for the rest of his education. On the day of John's graduation, he and the chief of medicine had a final talk. John remembers the man as being smart with a good heart, but he was too entrenched in the status quo. The chief of medicine sat him down and said, "John, I think you're a good doctor. I want you to know that. I want you to know that I like your family. That's why I'm going to tell you this. I'm concerned that you're going to starve to death with all your crazy ideas about food. All you're going to do is collect a bunch of bums and hippies." John paused to gather his thoughts, and then said, "That may be the case. Then I'll have to starve. I can't put people on drugs or surgeries that don't work. Besides, I think you're wrong. I don't think it will be bums and hippies. I think it will be successful people who have done well in life. They'll ask themselves, 'I'm such a big success, so how come I'm so fat?'" With that, John looked at the chief's generous belly and continued, "They'll ask, 'If I'm such a big success, why are my health and my future out of control?' They'll look at what I have to say, and they're going to buy it." John finished his formal medical education, having had only 1 hour of nutrition instruction, which involved learning which infant formulas to use. His experience confirms every study that has found nutrition training among physicians to be sorely inadequate. Hooked on drugs. John touched on another important area where the medical profession has lost credibility: its ties to the drug industry. Medical education and drug companies are in bed together, and have been for quite some time. John talked some about the depth of the problem and how the educational system has been corrupted. He said, "The problem with doctors starts with our education. The whole system is paid for by the drug industry, from education to research. The drug industry has bought the minds of the medical profession. It starts the day you enter medical school. All the way through medical school, everything is supported by the drug industry." John is not alone in criticizing the way in which the medical establishment has partnered with the drug industry. Many prominent scientists have published scathing observations showing how corrupt the system has become. Among the common observations are, the drug industry ingratiates itself with medical students with free gifts, including meals, entertainment, and travel. Educational events, including lectures, which are little more than drug advertisements, and conferences, which include speakers who are little more than drug spokespeople. Graduate medical students, physicians residents, and other physicians actually change their prescribing habits because of information provided by drug salespeople. Even though this information is known to be overly positive and prescribing habits are less appropriate as a result. Research and academic medicine merely carry out the pharmaceutical industry's bidding. This can happen because the drug companies, and not researchers, may design the research, which allows the company to rig the study. The researchers may have a direct financial stake in the drug company whose product they are studying. The drug company may be responsible for collecting and collating the raw data, and then only selectively allow researchers to view the data. The drug company may retain veto power over whether the findings are published, and may retain editorial rights over any scientific publications resulting from the research. The drug company may hire a communications firm to write the scientific article, and then find researchers willing to attach their names as authors of the paper after it has already been written. The major scientific journals have turned into little more than marketing vehicles for drug companies. The leading medical journals derive their primary income from drug advertising. This advertising is not adequately reviewed by the journal, and companies often present misleading claims about drugs. Perhaps more disconcerting, the majority of clinical trial research reported in the journals is funded by drug company money, and the financial interests of the researchers involved are not fully acknowledged. In the past couple of years, there have been well-publicized scandals at major medical centers that confirm these charges. In one instance, a scientist's integrity was maligned in a variety of ways by both a drug company and her university administration after she found that a drug under study had strong side effects and lost its effectiveness. In another case, a scientist speaking out about the possible side effects of antidepressants lost a job opportunity at the University of Toronto. The examples go on and on. Dr. Marcia Angel, an ex-editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, wrote a scathing editorial called "Is Academic Medicine for Sale?" The ties between clinical researchers and industry include not only grant support, but also a host of other financial arrangements. Researchers serve as consultants to companies whose products they are studying, join advisory boards and speakers' bureaus, enter into patent and royalty arrangements, agree to be the listed authors of articles ghostwritten by interested companies, promote drugs and devices at company-sponsored symposiums, and allow themselves to be plied with expensive gifts and trips to luxurious settings. Many also have equity interest in the companies. Dr. Angel goes on to say that these financial associations often significantly bias research, both the kind of work that is done and the way it is reported. Even more dangerous than the threat of fraudulent findings is the fact that the only type of research that is funded and recognized is research on drugs. Research on the causes of disease and non-drug interventions simply doesn't occur in medical education settings. For example, academic researchers may be furiously trying to find a pill that will treat the symptoms of obesity, but not be devoting any time or money to teaching people how to live a healthier life. Dr. Angel writes, "In terms of education, medical students and house officers, under the constant tutelage of industry representatives, learn to rely on drugs and devices more than they probably should. As the critics of medicine so often charge, young physicians learn that for every problem, there is a pill and a drug company representative to explain it. They also become accustomed to receiving gifts and favors from an industry that uses these courtesies to influence their continuing education. The academic medical centers, in allowing themselves to become research outposts for industry, contribute to the overemphasis on drugs and devices." In this environment, is it possible for nutrition to be given fair and honest consideration? Despite the fact that our leading killers can be prevented and even reversed using good nutrition, will you ever hear about it from your doctor? Not as long as this environment persists in our medical schools and hospitals. Not unless your doctor has decided that standard medical practice, as it is taught, does not work, and decides to spend a significant amount of time educating himself or herself about good nutrition. This takes a rare individual. The situation has gotten so bad that Dr. John McDougall said, "I don't know what to believe anymore. When I read a paper that says I should be giving my heart patients beta blockers and ACE inhibitors, two classes of heart drugs, I don't know whether it's true. I honestly don't know if it's true because drug research is so tainted." Do you think the following headlines are related? Schools report research interest conflicts between drug companies and researchers. Prescription use by children multiplying, study says. Survey: many guidelines written by doctors with ties to companies. Correctly prescribed drugs take heavy toll, millions affected by toxic reactions. We pay a high price for allowing these medical biases. A Journal of the American Medical Association study found that 1 in 5 new drugs will either get a black box warning, indicating a previously unknown serious adverse reaction that may result in death or serious injury, or will be withdrawn from the market within 25 years. 20% of all new drugs have serious unknown side effects, and more than 100,000 Americans die every year from correctly taking their properly prescribed medication. This is one of the leading causes of death in America. Dr. McDougall's fate. When Dr. John McDougall finished his formal medical education, he set up a practice on the Hawaiian island of Oahu. He began writing books about nutrition and health and established a national reputation. In the mid-1980s, John was contacted by St. Helena Hospital in Napa Valley, California, and asked if he would accept a position running its health center. The hospital was a Seventh-day Adventist hospital. If you recall from Chapter 7, the Seventh-day Adventists encourage followers to eat a vegetarian diet, even though they consume higher-than-average amounts of dairy products. It was an opportunity too good to pass up, and John left Hawaii for California. John had a good home at St. Helena for a number of years. He taught nutrition and used nutrition to treat sick patients, which he did with fantastic success. He treated over 2,000 very sick patients, and over the course of 16 years, he has never been sued or even had a letter of complaint. Perhaps more importantly, John saw these patients get well. Throughout this time, he continued his publishing activity, maintaining a national reputation. But as time passed, he realized that things weren't quite the same as when he first arrived. His discontent was growing. Of those later years, he says, "I just didn't think I was going anyplace. The program had 150 or 170 people a year, and that was it. never grew, wasn't getting any support from the hospital, and we had gone through a lot of administrators. He had small clashes with the other doctors at the hospital. At one point, the heart department objected to what John was doing with heart patients. John told them, "I'll tell you what, I'll send every one of my heart patients to you for a second opinion if you'll send yours to me." It was quite an offer, but they didn't accept it. On another occasion, John had referred a patient to a cardiologist, and the cardiologist incorrectly told the patient that he needed to have bypass surgery. After a couple of these incidents, John had reached the limit of his patience. Finally, after the cardiologist recommended surgery for another one of John's patients, John called him and said, "I want to talk with you and the patient about this. I would like to discuss the scientific literature that causes you to make this recommendation." The cardiologist said that he wouldn't do that, to which John responded, "Why not? You just recommended that this guy have his heart opened, and you're going to charge him $50,000 or $100,000 for it. Why don't we discuss it? Don't you think that's fair to the patient?" The cardiologist declined, saying that it would just confuse the patient. That was the last time he recommended heart surgery for one of John's patients. Meanwhile, none of the other physicians in the hospital had ever referred a patient to John. Not once. Other physicians would send their own wives and children to see him, but they would never refer a patient. The reason, according to John, "They were worried about what would happen when their patients would come to see me, and it happened all the time when patients would come on their own. They'd come to me with heart disease or high blood pressure or diabetes. I'd put them on the diet, and they'd go back off all their pills, and soon their numbers would be normal. They'd go to their doctor and say, 'Why the hell didn't you tell me about this before? Why did you let me suffer, spend all this money, almost die, when all I had to do was eat oatmeal?'" The doctors didn't want to hear this. There were other moments of friction between John and the hospital, but the last straw involved Dr. Roy Swank's multiple sclerosis program mentioned in Chapter 9. John had contacted Dr. Swank when he learned that Swank was about to retire. John had known and respected Dr. Roy Swank for a long time, and he offered to take over the Swank MS program and merge it with his health clinic at St. Helena Hospital, preserving it in honor of Dr. Swank. Dr. Swank agreed, much to John's excitement. As John said, there were four reasons that this would be a perfect fit for St. Helena's. It fit in with the philosophy of the Adventists, dietary treatment of disease. They would be helping people who desperately needed their help. It would double their patient census, helping to grow the program. It would cost almost nothing. In thinking back on it, John said, "Could you think of any reason not to do this? It was obvious." So he took the proposal to the head of his department. After listening, she said that she didn't think the hospital wanted to do this. She said, "Well, I don't think we really want to introduce any new programs right now." John, dumbfounded, asked her, "Please, tell me why. What does it mean to be a hospital? Why are we here? I thought we were here to take care of sick people." Her response was a doozy. "Well, you know we are, but you know, MS patients are not really desirable patients. You told me yourself that most neurologists don't like to take care of MS patients." John could not believe what he had just heard. In a very tense moment, he said, "Wait a minute. I'm a doctor. This is a hospital. As far as I know, our job is to relieve the suffering of the sick. These are sick people. Just because other doctors can't help them in their suffering doesn't mean that we can't. Here's the evidence that says we can. I have an effective treatment for people who need my care, and this is a hospital. Will you explain to me why we don't want to take care of those kinds of patients?" He continued, "I want to talk to the head of the hospital. I want to explain to her why I need this program and why the hospital needs this program and why the patients need this program. I want you to get me an appointment." Ultimately, though, the head of the hospital proved to be just as difficult. John reflected on the situation with his wife. He was supposed to renew his contract with the hospital in a couple of weeks, and he decided not to do it. He left on cordial terms, and to this day he does not hold personal grudges. He just explains it by saying that their directions in life were different. John would prefer to remember St. Helena for what it was, a good home to him for 16 years, but a place nonetheless that was just into that whole drug money thing. Now John runs a highly successful lifestyle medicine program with his family's help, writes a popular newsletter that he makes freely available, www.drmcdougall.com, organizes group trips with past patients and new friends, and has more time to go windsurfing when the wind picks up on Bodega Bay. This is a man with a wealth of knowledge and qualifications who could benefit the health of millions of Americans. He has never been challenged by any of his colleagues for physician misbehavior, and yet the medical establishment does not want his services. He is reminded of this fact all the time. Patients will come in with rheumatoid arthritis. They'll be in wheelchairs. They can't even turn the key on their car. And I'll take care of them, and 3 or 4 weeks later, they'll go back to see their doctor. They'll walk up to their doctor, grab their hand, and shake it hard. Doctor will say, "Wonderful." The patient, all excited, will say, "Well, I want to tell you what I did. I went to see this Dr. McDougall. I changed my diet, and now my arthritis is gone." Their doctor simply responds, "Oh my goodness, that's great. Whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. I'll see you later." That's always the response. It's not, "Please, my God, tell me what you did so I can tell the next patient." It's, "Whatever you're doing, that's just great." If the patient starts to tell them they've changed to a vegetarian diet, the doctor will cut in with, "Yeah, okay, fine. You're really a strong person. Thanks a lot. See you later." Get them out of the office as quickly as they can. It's very threatening. Very threatening. Esselstein's reward. Back in Ohio, Dr. Esselstein retired from active surgery in June of 2000 and assumed the position of preventive cardiology consultant in the Department of General Surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. He has continued to do research and to visit with patients. He holds 3-hour counseling sessions in his home with new heart disease patients, gives them research evidence, and provides a delicious, heart-safe meal. In addition, he gives talks around the country and abroad. In March of 2002, S. and his wife Anne, whose grandfather founded the Cleveland Clinic, drafted a letter to the head of the cardiology department and the head of the hospital at the clinic. The letter started off by saying how proud they were of the reputation and excellence of the clinic and the innovation of the surgical procedures, but that everyone recognized that surgery was never going to be the answer to this epidemic of heart disease. S. formally proposed the idea that he could help set up an arrest and reversal dietary program in the Department of Preventive Cardiology at the Cleveland Clinic. The program would mirror his own and could be administered by nurse clinicians and physician assistants. Ideally, a young physician with passion for the idea would head the program. Ultimately, every patient with heart disease at the clinic would be offered the option of arrest and reversal therapy using dietary means, which costs very little, harbors no risks, and puts the control back into the patient's hands. You'd think that if an opportunity arose to profoundly heal sick people, and one of the most reputable people in the country was going to help you, a hospital would jump at the opportunity. But after being one of the star surgeons at the Cleveland Clinic for decades, after initiating a heart disease reversal study that had greater success than anything ever done at the clinic, and after graciously offering a plan to help heal even more people, S. wasn't even contacted. Neither the head of the hospital nor the department head had the respect to even acknowledge that he had written to them. They didn't call. They didn't write. They completely ignored him. 7 weeks passed, and finally S. called the department head and the hospital head, and neither of them would take his call. Finally, after 7 calls, the head of the hospital got on the phone. This man had praised S. for years for his research and seemed excited by his results, but now he was singing a different tune. He obviously knew exactly what S. was calling about and told S. that the head of the cardiology department didn't want to do it. In other words, he just passed the buck. If the head of the hospital wanted it to be done, it would be done, regardless of what the head of cardiology wanted. So S. called the head of cardiology, who finally took his call. The man was abrasive and rude. He made it clear he had no interest in what S. was trying to do. S. hasn't talked to either of these doctors since, but he still has hope that he can change their minds as more and more research supports what he has been saying. Meanwhile, many people at the clinic are still excited about S.'s work. Many of them want to see a wider application of his program, but the powers that be will not let it happen. They get frustrated, and S. is likewise frustrated, because the current program in preventive cardiology is a disaster. They still eat meat, they still eat dairy, and they don't have any cholesterol goal. It's all just so vague. Preventive cardiology takes great pride when they are able to slow the rate of progression of this disease. This isn't cancer, for God's sake. An interesting situation is now developing. Just as with Dr. McDougall, many of the clinic bigwigs with heart disease have themselves gone to Esselstein for treatment and lifestyle counseling. They know it works, and they seek out the program on their own. As S. says, this could be developing into a very interesting crisis. I have now treated a number of senior staff with coronary disease at the clinic, senior staff physicians. I have also treated a number of senior staff trustees. One of the trustees knows about the frustrations that we've had trying to get this into the clinic, and he says, "I think if the word gets out that Esselstein has this treatment that arrests and reverses this disease at the Cleveland Clinic, and it's been used by senior staff, and he's treated senior trustees, but he's not permitted to treat the common herd, we could be open for a lawsuit." For the time being, S., with his wife's help, will continue to run counseling sessions out of his own home because the institution to which he gave the greater part of his life does not want to endorse a dietary approach that competes with its standard menu of pills and procedures. This past summer, S. spent much more time than usual at his upstate New York farm, making hay. As much as S. likes a more relaxed life, he would also love to continue to help diseased people get better with the aid of the Cleveland Clinic. But they won't allow him to. This is nothing short of criminal. We, the public, turn to doctors and hospitals in times of great need. For them to provide care that is knowingly less than optimal, that doesn't protect our health, doesn't heal our disease, and costs us tens of thousands of dollars, is morally inexcusable. S. sums up the situation. The clinic is now injecting stem cells to try to make new heart vessels grow. Wouldn't it be easier to stop the disease? It's appalling, isn't it? It's just so grippingly unbelievable to think that we're being led around by people who refuse to believe the obvious. Both Esselstein and McDougall have now been denied re-entry into the establishment, after headline-making success at healing people with a nutritional approach. You can focus on the money, according to John and S. 80% of St. Helena's and 65% of the Cleveland Clinic's respective incomes were generated by traditional heart disease treatments, surgical interventions. But it's something more than just money. It may also be the intellectual threat that the patient should be in control and not the doctor. That something as simple as food could be more powerful than all the knowledge of pills and high-tech procedures. It may be the lack of credible nutrition education in medical school. It may be the influence of the drug industry. Whatever it is, it has become clear that the medical industry in this country is not protecting our health as it should. As McDougall reaches his arms out, palms up, and scrunches his shoulders up, he simply says, "It's beyond comprehension." since the first edition. From Thomas M. Campbell, M.D. After co-authoring the first edition of the China Study with my dad, I had a new passion for nutrition and health and decided to pursue a medical degree. The 4 years I spent working closely with my dad on this book were a sort of apprenticeship in nutrition literature review and communication. I had spent time with thousands of abstracts, reading hundreds of nutrition science publications, and discussing and arguing and learning with one of the top nutritional biochemists of the past 50 years. I knew how powerful a WFPB diet could be in preventing and reversing some of our more common chronic diseases, and I knew well that my medical education would be a time largely devoid of diet and lifestyle information. Since the first edition of this book, the amount of nutrition education in medical school remains scandalous. Survey results published in 2010 show that on average, medical students get a total of about 20 hours of nutrition education during their 4-year education. Essentially nothing. My own training experience reinforced the notion that nutrition is ignored. The small number of hours present were focused almost entirely on biochemistry and metabolism, and had almost no bearing on using nutrition to prevent and treat the illnesses that all doctors see every day. What I believe has improved since the first edition of this book is the extent of the direct marketing relationship between industry and medical education. In the mid to late 2000s, when I was in medical school, I was at clinics that sometimes had lunches provided by drug representatives, who in turn were able to attend and share promotional materials for their products. My impression is that this type of direct marketing has been seriously subsiding over the past 10 years, at least among academic medical centers. As a resident doctor, and then as a board-certified family physician at a major academic medical center, I did not benefit from any industry-branded gifts, free lunches, pens, drug samples, etc., during my training. That is true generally of students, residents, and practitioners at the University of Rochester. The University of Rochester Medical Center has a strict policy that regulates interactions between pharmaceutical and device industries and practitioners. Industry continues to play a major role in medical research, and this core relationship has far-reaching implications in setting the paradigms of how we identify and treat disease, perpetuating the status quo. But in a growing percentage of academic medical centers, industry no longer has a direct line to market their products directly to trainees and practitioners. I was prepared for the terrible gap in education that leaves nutrition out of the picture, but I could not be fully prepared for the individual suffering that results. Countless individuals are suffering terribly right now with illnesses caused or strongly exacerbated by poor nutrition. These patients have often interacted with dozens of health professionals, most of whom are, without a doubt, extraordinarily hard-working, intelligent, caring, and kind. And these patients have never been told about the potential of nutrition to prevent and reverse illness. Through my journey, they have been a stark reminder of how poorly our medical system sometimes functions. Since the original publication of the China Study, though, there has been great reason for hope and optimism. The Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute now offers a 6-hour group counseling seminar with Dr. Esselstein. Montefiore Hospital offers a similar program. Continuing medical education conferences on plant-based nutrition draw hundreds of health practitioners annually. A preventive medicine training program at Maine Medical Center will incorporate plant-based nutrition training. Kaiser Permanente, one of the largest health systems in the country, published a paper in its journal suggesting that physicians recommend plant-based diets to all their patients. Other hospital systems from Lee County, Florida to Midland, Texas, have been incorporating plant-based nutrition into their patient care with the help of Plant Pure Wellness, my brother Nelson Campbell's organization, as have a growing variety of private medical practices like the Barnard Medical Center. Thousands of lay people and hundreds of healthcare practitioners are getting educated in plant-based nutrition through the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition.